From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The light that we can see at the end of the tunnel is getting brighter and brighter as more people get vaccinated. The number of people going into the hospital each day with COVID-19 has dropped. The total number of patients fighting COVID-19 in the hospital is beginning to level off. And our statewide ICU bed availability is above 20%. As a result, on Friday, May 14th, the state of Illinois will move into the bridge phase of our mitigation plan, one step closer to removing nearly all of the remaining mitigations. And barring any significant reversals in key COVID-19 statewide indicators, Illinois will move to phase five, normal business operations, free of pandemic-related mitigations, as soon as Friday, June 11th.
That's Governor J.B. Pritzker with some long-awaited news that the COVID numbers seem to be going in the right direction and the state is creeping closer to a full reopening of the economy. We're also going to talk about redistricting in Illinois. Democrats moving ahead with the remap process. Republicans not happy about that. That and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also with us, Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois State House editor. And joining us today, Mark Maxwell. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for WCIA-TV. And Mark, it's always good to have you with us.
Yeah, Sean, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start talking about the latest news when it comes to the pandemic. Hannah, this is good news, I would think. The governor announcing the state's bridge phase, meaning higher gathering capacity limits, they'll be kicking in at the end of next week. It's not where we want to get to, but it is a positive step, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have been waiting on this for a while. If you remember, the governor announced this so-called bridge phase back in mid-March. But almost immediately, even though we started meeting those vaccination goals fairly soon after that, new cases kept going up, and then hospitalizations, which was a key metric in getting us to that phase, also went up in tandem. I do want to point out that we're still, 800, on average, about 800 more hospitalizations than we were in mid-March, but the metrics are that if we have decreasing hospitalizations, decreasing new hospitalizations, those are two different things, over a 28-day period, then we are in the clear to get to that bridge phase where we'll have more capacity, expanded capacity limits for businesses and social gatherings. And it's a bridge to get us to phase five, which, you know, a year ago, the governor announced this phase five, and we could not imagine what our world would look like then. But it's, you know, everything is open again, no more COVID restrictions, save for the governor says that we'll still have to wear masks in public per CDC guidance.
Yeah, phase five, I think he said June 11th is what we could be targeting. What are some things to be watching for heading closer to that point that could derail that target, Hannah? What do you think could be a problem as we get closer?
So again, you know, the metrics have to be that we have to not see another spike, a big increase in both overall hospitalizations and new entrants to the hospital for COVID-like illness. And then we also have to make sure that our ICU capacity remains above 20% free.
Charlie, we've been reading and following these numbers for so long. We watch them on a daily basis, and we've been hearing about vaccine, that there's been a bit of a slowdown. I guess that's not something we should be surprised about, though, correct?
It's probably kind of to be expected, because if you look at the general populace, some people were really enthusiastic, really wanted to get a vaccine as soon as they could. I was one of those. And there are other people, including people in the healthcare profession, who held back. Some of them said, well, I want to see how it goes. I want to see what kind of side effects there are. I want to see how effective it is. And then there are folks who argue that, well, I don't need a vaccine because this stuff is no worse than the flu. or because I don't want Bill Gates inserting microchips in my body, that kind of stuff. And so I would guess that most of the people who were enthusiastic have already got the shots. And I think within the coming days, the Pfizer vaccine for younger people, people aged 12 and up, is going to be approved. And that's going to have another spurt. And I think one of the big things that the governor announced is that we are now going to have vaccines available in doctor's offices rather than just the designated vaccine sites. And so the theory is that people who don't want to go to some site where they don't know the people or maybe they're reluctant to get a vaccine, if they can go to the family doctor, the person that they've dealt with for years for their health care, that may overcome some of the reluctance. But I guess there will always be people who just don't believe in vaccines, don't believe in medicine or whatever, who'll be out there resisting. The object is to get as many of the rest of us vaccinated as possible so that we can resume some kind of semblance of normalcy and let the naysayers let them out there on their own, I guess.
Yeah, Mark, you don't want to get your hopes up too much because we've sort of seen that before. Things were going right and then they don't go so right. But the governor has taken a lot of heat from different groups as far as, the restaurant owners, bar owners, many others who have, felt that some of his decisions to shut down the economy might have been going too far. Now that at least he's making these nuances toward possibly reopening the economy and, within a month or so, that's got to take a little bit of pressure off the governor, doesn't it?
I think you're right. There is some political pressure there. And it's interesting to watch the timing here, too, because just last week, Congressman Rodney Davis, who is a Republican and sometimes rumored to be a potential candidate to run for governor, we'll see. He had another interesting incentive to go get vaccinated. He said, hey, everybody, go get your vaccine so the governor has no excuse to keep our businesses locked down. Is it a coincidence that the very next week the governor starts to say, okay, here's when we're going to open up? Maybe. But there is some political pressure to reopen. The governor, I think, and his administration are eager to do that. One way they're doing that, which was interesting, in New Jersey, they're providing a shot and a beer. The government partnered with their local breweries to say, if you get your vaccine, we'll give you a free beer. Well, in Illinois, Governor Pritzker went far downstate and offered 100 free shooting clays or clay pigeons, targets, essentially, to anybody who comes out to get their vaccine at the big shooting symposium they have down there. So he's trying to appeal to gun owners and firearms enthusiasts to say, hey, get your vaccine, you're going to get 100 free targets. A shot for a shot, I guess.
Well, and there's a lot of events, Hannah, that have been now discussed about taking place. Of course, we've heard here in Springfield and, of course, I guess DuQuoin as well, the state fairs. They're still a go as of right now. They're hoping to put those on, the Chicago Auto Show, among others. So there does feel like there is at least some of the pressure overall in the state coming off and that maybe we're going to actually have a little bit of normalcy this year. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's you want to give people hope. And so the announcement that the Chicago Auto Show, which normally is held in February, will go forward in July, and the state fair, and, Mark mentioned that that shooting range down in Sparta, it's, a pretty famous, important shooting range, and they have this annual competition, and that'll go on. It's like you said, it takes the pressure off, but it's still, at the end of the day, when the pandemic is over, whatever that actually means, we don't truly know, gonna have to take stock, and it also coincides with the governor trying to be reelected, even though he's still not formally announced that he was gonna seek reelection. And so it's not going to be everything's done, because there's still a lot of damage that was inflicted on businesses and individuals. When you look at the mess that the Illinois Department of Employment Security has been over the last year, there's still a lot of things that need fixing. But yes, pressure is going to be taken off.
Yeah, and Charlie, before we move on, that's certainly still a concern out there because the state finances, which is one way to gauge how the economy is doing in the state, is the type of revenue coming into the state, into state government, seems to be doing better than most people expected. The governor mentioned that this week, but that may be a temporary thing, and we may get more of the real picture farther down the road, correct?
Yeah, I think the indications are positive. Because, as you mentioned, the revenue reports from the Commission Government Forecasting and Accountability are showing that we're doing better than they than had been anticipated. And so that is a cause to be helpful. The Flash Index, which measures economic growth in the state, increased into positive territory in its most latest report from Professor Garrett's at University of Illinois, and it showed its largest increase in its history. All that indicates that the economy is coming back. Unemployment claims are down, but we're still not where we need to be. And I think, as was mentioned, there has to be a bit of caution and not too much exuberance about the fact that we're getting ready to enter the bridge phase next week, and we may be fully reopened in a month or so. And I think the governor said it best. He said that the virus and its variants had proven to be unpredictable.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Mark Maxwell with WCIA-TV. Mark, you spent time this week camped out in a cramped hallway at the Capitol complex outside of a locked door. What was taking place there?
Yeah, this was interesting. For years, we've heard about, the Democrats in power in Springfield drawing the redistricting maps behind a closed door. But I don't know if we ever saw the door. It turns out there's this fourth floor hallway in the Stratton Building. If you've ever been to Springfield, it's one of the most beautiful pieces of architecture. I don't know if the sarcasm comes through there. It's a really block-shaped building. Looks like it came out of the 1950s. It's this old place where some members they have offices stuck there, and no one ever really likes working in the Stratton Building. It's kind of like the place that no one wants to go. You avoid it at all costs. It's got some heating and air conditioning issues. And anyway, at the end of this long hallway, literally behind a bunch of barricaded furniture that was just sort of stashed and left and forgotten in the lobby, on the other end of that was this locked door with a key code. And someone told me, hey, you should go check out that location. It took me a while to find it. Once I got there and started I saw a bunch of House Democrats filing in and out and started asking them some questions. What's going on in the room? Are you drawing the maps and what's happening? It turns out the speaker's staff was showing each member the outline of their district. These are preliminary drafts. We expect that the House and the Senate will file an actual bill in the next week or two, most likely, that will show the public what the maps, the proposed maps could look like. But this was that sensitive time where each member was poring over the details, looking at how their district might change. And I think the optics of it really stood out, combined with just how nervous the lawmakers were to discuss it. So many of their lawyers have been telling them for weeks, be careful what you say to the press. Don't talk about this process more than you have to. They expect lawsuits. They expect depositions. They expect for these maps to be challenged in court. And it strikes me that a lot of the nerves and the squirming that we saw on camera in those hallway interviews was probably a factor of just how cautious they're trying to be as they pick the voters that may or may not send them back to their jobs. It's the question of, are politicians picking their voters, or does the public really get a say in how these maps are drawn?
Now, Mark, they did have hearings, I know, across the state, but what makes this, you mentioned the optics, what makes this such a story for you at this point?
Well, Representative Tim Butler and a number of other House Republicans held a press conference the next day to really make a point out of it, and it is the optics. I mean, they don't have the votes, they don't have the power to control this, but look, poll after poll in this state tell us that, and across the country, that most people prefer an independent commission or someone other than elected officials deciding, you know, who should, you know, how the districts are drawn. And he made the point that, look, these maps are being drawn in secret. I mean, look, the obvious fact is they had to draw them somewhere. In Illinois, the deliberative process is sort of sacred. I mean, even the Freedom of Information Act laws protect lawmakers from having to show their cards before they've decided on an issue, right? So that's, we sort of saw them in the process there. And, you know, we still, those public hearings that you referenced, I mean, they're so scarcely attended. I think I've covered four of them, I think. And I think there's been maybe six or seven people at most of them. One of them that was a House and Senate joint committee had like 12 people at it. So yeah, people can tune in online. The problem is it's very complex. Drawing these districts involves a very detailed understanding of data and demographics, and average Joe or, you know, Joe Q citizen, whoever, may not understand all of the different complexities that go into this. I mean, there's computer models that can spit out hundreds or thousands of different options of maps that have districts with probabilities that are skewed by 1 or 2%. And I don't know how confident most people are that they could walk up to a map and detect that just by looking at it. So it's a hard thing for the public to really engage in.
Yeah, Shirley, you followed this these remaps for decades and several of them. Anything that you're noticing about this one that's different from what you've seen in the past?
Not really. And I think the first one that I covered, and again, I date myself here, was in 1971. So, yeah, that's been a long time. But I guess I may be cynical, but if the roles were reversed and if the Republicans had a majority in the House, they would be doing things, quote, in secret, and the Democrats would be objecting and arguing for transparency. It's been how it's been all along. And I think another thing to keep in mind, as Bark said, this is a very complex subject. The data is enormous. It's even with computers, it's really hard to do. To give you an idea how precise it can be, though, when the maps were drawn, the current set of maps were drawn based on the census reports from 2010, the population variance between the district with the most people and the district with the fewest people was exactly one. And that was because the population couldn't be divided evenly by 118 for the House or 59 for the Senate. So that gives you an idea of how precise they can be. And I think I'd also make the observation that in the life of the average individual, how the maps are being drawn probably doesn't rate up there very high in terms of things that they're really concerned about. Now, folks like us who are into politics and enjoy watching the tumult, yeah, we get really engaged in it. But I would guess we're a relative minority.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, Shirley. But Mark, they have made it very clear about transparency. I mean, they, you know, and they've gotten a lot of probably positive press about saying that in many cases. And we're not necessarily seeing the action follow that that earlier promise. Is that correct?
Well, that's the optics of this, right? I mean, the whole secret door. Look, I think as a reporter, I get a little bit, I always tend to cringe a little bit when I see stories that really blow up the optics of something, because, you know, the actual effect matters more than just how it looks. But I think that you're right. We've heard at every single one of these hearings, the Democrat who's chairing the hearing, whether they're in the House or the Senate, they make it a point in their prepared remarks at the start to say, we are committed to transparency. I went back and looked at their transcripts, and it was like just almost robotic, verbatim, every single one. We're committed to transparency. Because they know that's something that the public cares about. There's a gentleman named Al Hooks with the NAACP who is testifying at one of these committee hearings that was about the maps. And he said, the number one most important thing to us, I'm paraphrasing him here, is that it's a transparent process. So I think to be fair, we have to point out that there are Muslim Americans, there are several different religious groups that have come to these hearings, and they have made the case that they deserve a district. So that process is happening. There are people that have filed written witness testimony, and they have said, you know, we don't want to see the city of Springfield, for example, chopped into three or four different districts. We want to see it represented by itself. There are communities of interest, they're called, where there's a lot of college campuses or what have you, that will come and say, they'll come to the legislature and say, don't divide us up. Don't dilute our voice or our voting power. We think that we deserve a seat. And so, you know, you can point to a room at the end of the hallway. I mean, and we did, and say, and you can question if this is a transparent process. But, you know, I don't think that we should also ignore that there is input coming into the process. At the end of the day, though, the reality here is that Democrats hold the votes, and it looks like they're going to pass whatever map they want. And so they're going to have to make the case along the way that, hey, we were transparent.
Well,
and I would add, it occurs to me that, in a way, the jury is still out on the question of transparency, because one of the things people are arguing for isn't necessarily that everybody sit in and kibitz as they're actually working the numbers. They want an opportunity, once the maps have been finalized, they want an opportunity to be able to review them, go over them, and pick them apart. I think they're asking for 2 weeks before there's a final vote, if I'm not mistaken. And there are conflicts here, because, for example, you mentioned how the city of Springfield wants to be all one district. But on the other hand, if you're interested in creating minority districts, it makes sense to link the east side of Springfield with Decatur because of the Black population. So you have those kinds of cross purposes to work with. And I know the Latino policy forum is asking that there be at least 20 majority Latinx districts, or they won't support the process. And so you have the conflict of, where do we create districts that will have a majority Hispanic population, and how do we balance that off against the need to create districts that have a majority of Black residents? And I think that, as we said earlier, this is a very complex, very difficult process. And I think I would withhold the judgment on transparency until we see what opportunity there is for the public to actually comment once the maps are in their, what would you say, in the form in which the Democrats want to present them to the public. And I'd also add, let me add one other thing. If the Republicans aren't doing the exact same thing, I think they're guilty of political malfeasance.
Well, just to answer that, they are drawing their own versions of maps and looking at all the data in the districts as well. Those maps won't pass because they don't have the votes to but they have the very same process going on where they're looking at it. But two quick points to Charlie's comments. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. This really is about racial diversity, and that's where the rubber meets the road. Almost every one of these single hearings, that's what it comes down to. Different minority groups want to make sure that their voices are going to be heard, and Illinois scores very highly on that metric. We score very poorly, on the political competition. And what that means is there are very, very strong, heavily Republican districts. There are very strong Democratic districts. And so, you know, reform advocates say that kind of poisons the whole promise of a general election, because all we have is a primary race. And then that person just sort of parachutes into the seat without ever having to face opposition from the other side of the aisle. And it's a less bipartisan legislature in the process. But that's the other thing, though. The issue of transparency really comes down to, what data are Democrats using for these maps? Because the full census data is not out yet. And so Republicans have tried to make some hay with that question, because the American Community Survey data, which is an estimate, has been wildly inaccurate. In fact, they say it undercounts minorities. So Republicans have, I think, tried to play a bit of racial politics there, too, and try to pit Black and brown communities against one another, perhaps, and suggest that, look, if Democrats use this incomplete data set that isn't the census, then you're going to be undercounted. And so they've tried to stoke those fears to undermine confidence in this process.
Just about a minute or so left here. And Mark, I want to go back to you on another story that you reported on this week. This was a computer hack that's occurred in the Attorney General's office. And what have you found out about the extent of this?
I think the Attorney General's office really needs to do a full accounting to the public about just how devastating this ransomware hack was. We think it was a group linked to a cyber outfit in Russia. What we know is that almost a month after their cyber network, their networks were breached, top officials very near the Attorney General himself still don't have access to their email accounts. They're trying to rebuild those servers, and they have not answered the question, are you going to pay the ransom to get the key back into your computer networks. I think that there needs to be accounting for that. We're talking about an agency that handles very sensitive investigations, lawsuits into big companies, into real victims of real crimes, and their information. There's a cyber outfit out there threatening to publish all of their sensitive information on the web unless the Attorney General's office does something. This story, the last chapter has not been written.
Okay, we'll continue to follow that. Let's go to our notes from the field. And Hannah, let's go to you first.
Right. So if we remember last fall, four former lobbyists and or executives from ComEd and its parent company, Exelon, were indicted on charges of, you know, being behind this wide-ranging bribery scheme wherein Mike Madigan, former House Speaker Mike Madigan, is public official A, though, of course, he has not been charged. Attorneys for Mike McLean, who was one of those very powerful lobbyists and a confidant of Mike Madigan, said this week during a status hearing that they were pretty sure that the feds were about to file a superseding indictment. And that means that, among other things, it could add new defendants and it could add a lot of new charges. And of course, the buzz jumped right to, oh my God, is Mike Madigan going to get indicted? It's obviously way too early to say. You know, you never want to predict what the feds will do because you really have no idea and it's just a fool's errand, but plenty to watch there.
Okay. Charlie?
Well, there's good news for the education community this week. Governor Pritzker said that he would revise his $42 billion budget that he proposed back in February to include an additional $350 million for education funding. And that's probably not really a surprise because from the get-go, I figured that that was the one aspect of his budget that would not hold up because there's a lot of agreement among lawmakers on both sides of the aisle that we have to continue to fund this evidence-based formula. And we didn't put in the $350 million last year or for this current fiscal year. Now it looks like it'll be there for FY22.
And Mark?
I want to point to or highlight some reporting from WGN Investigates Ben Bradley. They found that the state spent $4 million to lease out this old empty hospital, the Sherman Hospital in Elgin. It turns out they never sent a patient there. But what's more interesting is that the person who was leasing that hospital to the state was a former convicted felon named John Thomas. State law usually has a ban on doing business with or giving, you know, contracts to former felons, convicted felons. But that ban, that procurement law was suspended when the governor used his executive authority during the coronavirus crisis. So this $4 million went to this convicted felon fresh out of jail. And he now has a whole bunch of upgrades and renovations that were done to the hospital. And he now has control of it again. Quite a turn of events for a guy who found a way to cash in on COVID-19 spending.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Mark Maxwell with WCIA-TV. Get a podcast of our show. It's at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. And join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.